Hello, listeners, and welcome to the AfriWeta podcast, where we look to celebrate African history, people, and culture by telling our story. As always, our hope is that it fills you with enough curiosity to go and do your own deeper research. Karibu to any new listeners to the AfriWeta world. We invite you to check out previous AfriWeta episodes, which can be found on this podcast platform. Thank you so much for tuning in. Today, we're headed to the east of our continent for part one of the awesome Aksum Empire. One of the most influential empires in the world. A shout out to my Eastern Africans out there, AfriWeta has landed on your shores. I want to apologize in advance for the mispronunciation of words, which will most definitely happen. Before we begin, please remember to visit us on our socials. Our handle is at AfriWeta across all the platforms, where we post interesting facts, stories, updates, and links for further study for you lovely people. And please, please, please tell your friends and family about us. And for now, just sit back and enjoy the journey. Before we begin, a quick note. You are well aware that AfriWeta is really all about our continent and what our ancestors achieved. But for Aksum, just to give a little bit more context, it shall be one of those rare times we shall go beyond just a quick mention of foreign civilizations. And this is because Aksum's dominance and interaction with them was really quite extensive. So the Aksum Empire came into its own emerging from the kingdom of the same name in the late 1st century BC, which is also the last century BC. I know you're confused, don't worry, AfriWeta got you covered. Check out Series 1, Episode 2. Its influence was felt far and wide across our continent, spilling over into foreign lands. Indeed, we hear of Aksum in their histories. It's being recognized alongside the four great empires of that era, the Chinese, the Persian, and the Roman. So, when it comes to the modern location, my people, I hope you have your maps ready so we can trace and get our bearings right, yes? To all the newbies, I always ask that you get out your maps because it helps you to visualize the area. So, we're all set? The Aksum Empire's territory and dominance spanned from what is today's nations of Ethiopia, Eritrea, Djibouti, parts of Sudan and Somalia, which is basically mostly northeastern Africa. And from there, you can cross over the Cape Bari, which is Red Sea in Tigrinya. You see what I did for you people? You cross it and into modern-day Yemen, which is now on the South Arabian Peninsula. The city of Aksum, from where the empire derived its name, was actually declared a UNESCO World Heritage Site in AD 1980. So, let's look at the origin story. I found an interesting fact to share as we look at the origins of the empire, and this relates to one of the stories linked to the origin of the name itself, Aksum. So, there are two theories. The first is that it's an amalgamation of two words, A, which is the Agao word for water, and Gez, and the Gez word Shum, which means official. The second theory is that the second syllable stems from Sium, which is the Semitic name for chief. I would love to hear from our AfriWeta from that region as to what their take is on this, so please let AfriWeta know using our socials at AfriWeta. So now that we've heard the origins of the name, let's look at the origins of the civilization itself. Now, as is the norm, there are always a few theories out there about the origins of the civilizations. I will quickly touch on one that was touted and that today Honestly, if you search, it comes up as a valid origin story, but it has actually been found wanting by historians. So why the heck am I raising it here? Well, because I want to prove a teeny tiny point, so bear with me. There was once a kingdom called Demat, which is spelled D'MT, which is located in modern-day northern Ethiopia / Eritrea. This kingdom existed between circa 900-800 BC to about circa 400-300 BC. It is said to have been influenced strongly by the Saban culture and people. So who are these Saban, you ask? Well, this is where the controversy begins. So there was a group of historians who purported that Demat's origins were firmly in South Arabian roots and that its civilization and sophistication were as a result of these southern Arabs who had migrated south. These southern Arabs were called the Saban. Aksum was seen to be the direct successor of the Demat kingdom, and therefore it was also beholden to these South Arab migrants for its level of sophistication in their politics and society. So, what that means is, apparently, the only way Aksum could be such a force to contend with both within the continent and globally was purely because of outside influences, and never because it was a purely African civilization. Because, well, you know how Africans are not able to build great civilizations. Thankfully, for you guys, Afriwatu, you know better and even have proof of this fact. So, before I even start there, funnily enough, one of the strongest objections to this claim of the Damat-Saban link came from Rodolfo Fatovich, who was an Italian archaeologist, who stated, "The evidence I have reviewed in this article suggests that the Damat polity was deeply rooted in African social and cultural traditions, and the South Arabian component was only a superficial, though impressive, aspect of the society. The most important step forward in the research will be the abandonment of any ideological prejudice that about either the role of the Southern Arabs in forging the Ethiopian state and culture or the negation of this role. History is much more intricate and fascinating than archaeologists and historians think." I think that's a classic line, no? History is much more intricate and fascinating than archaeologists and historians think. Right, so now we've gotten that out of the way, let's go to the true origins and the more believable story of African genius, yes? So there are indeed artifacts and buildings in modern-day Tigray, where the city of Aksum is, which is in Ethiopia. The particular nine sites are oft quoted were actually built in a southern Arabic style, and you will find some Sabaic inscriptions. It is from this that some of these previous scholars were even more convinced of their theory to fit their very narrow narrative. But that was not the full story, as we shall soon find out over the next two episodes when we talk about this empire. Damat really did exist, and it was a complex state, practicing a hierarchical societal structure. Its ruins include temples in modern-day Yeha that have within them clues to that structure, namely seven particular sculptures and 15 royal inscriptions. Please go and read up on it. Another truth is that in Damat, it did have the South Arabian culture, and linguists have weighed in to link the ethnogenesis, which means the formation or emergence of an ethnic group. You're welcome. The ethnogenesis of the people to the Semitic historical languages. However, this did not then mean that the South Arabs took over the local populace. In fact, they were migrants who, upon getting to the Tigrayan highlands, mixed in with the existing polity and society, which explains the archaeological finds. There were also further archaeological finds from Nubia by the same Robert Fatovich. Yes, Nubia is on the Afriwetu list of civilizations, which can be linked to Ethiopia. These include the ancient pottery and other materials that are distinctly of African origin and predate the South Arabian migration, showing the existence of a complex African state. Aksum is accepted as more or less being the successor state of the Damat Kingdom. That is true. It rose to power and from the last century BC through to the 4th century AD, conquering lands left, right, and center. This was its expansion period. It expanded its territory west, taking over the Meroe civilization, then kept on going further north, further eastwards, crossing the Kebari into the Arabian coast. I hope that has all sunk in for everybody. Random interesting fact, which I wanted to throw in here, which is about the dating system. So this empire has a lot of really dope random facts, and I was trying to find a way to introduce them, privately geek out, but also make sure that you still all stay tuned in. So here goes. I'm sure you know that Ethiopians celebrate New Year's Day, which is, I'm sure I'm going to butcher this, Rise Awade Amet in Ge'ez, the ancient language. But it's not on the 1st of Jan. Instead, it is around the 11th of September. And during a leap year, it's on the 12th of September. This is because they follow the Orthodox Church and not the Gregorian calendar. Please stay with me now. The Gregorian calendar was proclaimed in AD 1582 by Pope Gregory the 18th. So get it? Gregorian, Gregory. And it replaced the previous Julian calendar. It is a solar dating system that is now in general use. The Gregorian calendar has within it the BC-AD dating system, which calculates Christ's birth 7 to 8 years prior to the Ethiopian Orthodox calendar. And then in addition to a different calendar, Ethiopians also have several eras within their dating system and different ways of calculating their years and months. So the first one is the era of the world, W, which is the number of years from what they count as the creation of the world. The second era is the era of incarnation, I, which is counted from the birth of Christ, that is the year W5500. Then you have the third one, which is the era of the martyrs, D, from which was the Diocletian's ascent into power, which was I276. That was also the year W5776, which is basically I276 plus W5500. Are we still together? Just have two more eras to explain. Then we have the era of the 352-year cycles from the creation of the world, which means, and I sincerely hope this makes sense, that the 11th cycle ended with the year W5852, which is basically W5500 plus 352. This is also the same as I352, which is also the same as the Gregorian calendar, that is AD 359/360. Then they also had the era of mercy, or the era of grace, from the conversion of to Christianity, starting with G1. This meant that year 1 was also the same as I353 and W5853 and AD 360/361. Have I totally confused all of you? I know that you'll have to replay that, right? In all honesty, it took me a few days to get my head around this. I can see the people in the studio scratching their heads. So the other difference when it comes to the dating system is the date of Christ's birth. Whereas 25th December is Christmas for most Christians, the Ethiopians celebrate it on the 7th of January, along with many other Orthodox churches. And to be fair, this is a closer date to the actual real date of Christ's birth. But this is not a story for this particular podcast. And then last of all, a year in the Ethiopian calendar is 13 months long, with 12 months of 30 days each. The last month, called Pagume, has 5 days ordinarily and 6 days during the leap year. So not only are the actual dates different, the actual eras different, but also the years. Are we still together? It's easy to see how guys get these confused, but once understood, it kind of makes sense, right? although I promise if you meet me out on these here streets, please don't ask me to calculate these dates for you because I will not know how to do it. I'm just being honest. Right, let's head into the expansion of this magnificent empire and leave the head scratching for a bit, tackling something a little bit easier. So as is the case then and now, trade and trade routes are key components to the strength of any state's economy. The Aksum Empire, as we shall see later when we look at trade, was no different, and understanding its expansion journey will kind of set this up really nicely. So Aksum gained control, dominated, and had great influence not just within our continent, but all the way across the seas and the oceans to the Arabian Peninsula, Europe and Asia, particularly India and China. Through both its conquered territory, its commercial and trading might, and sophisticated foreign policy agenda, it was able to exert such influence. Aksum was always on the lookout to create and solidify diplomatic relations with other states when they weren't trying to conquer them, that is. And by the 6th century, all of these efforts came to pass as Aksum was at its zenith in terms of political power, influence, as well as territory. It was actually on par with other great African empires that we have spoken about previously on AfriWare 2. Yes, internal plug, check them out. With the ruler, the Negusu Negest, which meant the King of Kings of Aksum, wielding great power at the helm. In the 3rd and 4th centuries, after undertaking a number of expeditions from AD 330, it had occupied territories along the Arab coastline on the Kebari, and Aksum took over and soon dominated the trading ports and routes on the Upper Nile. It strategically placed its navies and garrisons to secure these routes and its interests along this coastline. It continued to conquer its powerful neighbors, and under Negus Azana, the mighty city of Meroe fell, and by AD 350, so did the rest of the kingdom of Kush. Negus Azana claimed to be carrying out his Christian duty, saving the Noba people, fellow Christians in Nubia, from oppression, which is what was led to his invasion of Meroe. The same Negus Azana, this guy was busy, was also conquering the Beja people. Then, as if to just rub it in, he gave himself the title Negusa of Beja. The rulers of the land were then sent into exile and the peoples dispersed into other lands. We'll hear a little bit more about Azana in part 2 of this empire, so please, please, please tune in. Then we have a massacre which is worth noting here, which is the Najran massacre, where thousands of Christians were persecuted and slaughtered by the Jewish Hamorite king Yusuf Asa Yatha, also known as Du Nuas. This had a direct impact on the Aksum expansion. It spurned the Aksum ruler at the time, Negus Elesbas, or more commonly known as Negus Caleb, to invade Yemen in AD 520 to save the persecuted Christians. Similar story to his ancestor Azana. This invasion also meant the downfall of Du Nuas, and this was the final nail in the coffin for the kingdom of Judah. On taking over, Aksum then converted that kingdom to Christianity, and for his efforts, Negus Caleb was actually canonized by the church. So these plus subsequent military campaigns solidified its position of power and domination in the region, wielding great influence across the African, Arab, and Asian continents. And truly, the only way was up, and they kept on dominating the region for a further 6 centuries. People, 600 years. So now we've set that up, we can start looking at the trade and economy of this mighty empire. So can we just start with a really cool thing about this empire? It was the first sub-Saharan civilization to have its own minted coinage in gold, silver, bronze. And because Africans are just extra, there was also a type of coin that was gilded silver and bronze because, you know, why not? These are the coins that were used to trade, and Aksum was minting them from the late 3rd century and kept at it for a further 300 years. I hope by now, as we're heading into the trade, you're starting to understand the powerhouse that was Axum. It really was a giant of its day. So Axum itself had four key ports: Adulis, which is in modern day Eritrea; Malau, which is in modern day city of Berbera; Zelia and Hees, all in modern day Somaliland. All of these were docking stations for international ships, and so they were central to the trade along the Kebari. There are many historical accounts, including well-known shipping guides, for example, by that of the Greek merchant trader who was an eyewitness and who operated out of Egypt. His guide has a very complicated Latin name that I'm not even going to try, but in English, it is called the Circumnavigation of the Erythraean Sea, which covered the period AD 40 to AD 70. So please, go and read on it. Of these ports, these four main ports, Adulis was the main one for inland continental caravans, whose routes were already controlled by Axum. One would find other states that were not actually under the empire's direct rule would use this trade ecosystem and would bring their local goods and therefore also get profit from this very profitable system. Axum played a major role along the East African coastline, with its influence spreading as far south as Tanzania. So Eritrea to Tanzania is circa 2,450 kilometers. So if you flew in a straight line, it would take you almost 3 hours, just to give you an idea of the expanse. In fact, excavations down the coastline reveal the level of interaction of other ancient civilizations from the trade with Axum. You find glass fragments, royal pharaonic pendants, a stela which boasts a large ankh. So an ankh, spelled A-N-K-H, is an African-Egyptian symbol. It was also known as the key of life or the key of the Nile. They were also able to find scarabs, including one from Thutmose III of the 25th dynasty. Scarabs are beetle-shaped gems linked to our African-Egyptian ancestors as well. Included in the finds, there were also coins from the Ptolemaic and Roman civilizations, as well as from the Indian civilization of Kushna, which lasted from about 68 to 230 AD. So really, really far and wide. Commercial and merchant ships would dock at Axum ports, including that of the one in Yemen in the Gulf of Aden. Ships from the lands of the Arabs, Indians, Chinese, and Romans. These docks and routes included the ancient Silk Road that linked the capital city of Axum through the port of Adulis to the rest of the world. So really, history really does repeat itself, as in the 20th and 21st centuries, we have seen the huge influx and presence of Indian, Chinese economic migrants, as well as a large number of European immigrants coming to the continent seeking to make their fortune. Axum's prosperity was also contributed to through the trade of its own resources such as gold, iron, copper, ivory, rhino horn, the most sought commodities then and now. Other popular goods that went through their ports, which were carried on caravans, included cotton, steel, and spices such as saffron and cinnamon. Then you had silk, muslin, linens from Egypt, India, and China, luxury items like olive oil from Europe, wine, jewelry from brass and glass. And because we're on a roll of just naming different goods, some other examples were like ebony, tortoise shells, horses, as well as myrrh and frankincense, what we now call aromatic resins. Sounds so posh. And all of these plus more contributed to Axum's wealth. So when we think about the people, who are these people who created such an extensive trade network and whose reach saw them dominate both within the continent and across the seas? So let's have a quick look at the societal structure that supported the empire, as well as life as a subject of the empire. As expected, the empire had multiple groups of people, some of whom stood out, such as the Agao, and we shall have a quick look at them in a few to see why. So let's just start with a mini geek moment. The population of Axum had within it three main linguistic threads: Cushitic, Nilo-Saharan, and Semitic. Now, in studying the civilization, I found out a lot about the linguistic importance in relation to Axum, and it was honestly quite fascinating, and I promise, so please, 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 please go and read up some more. So for those who are new to the three terms I mentioned, Here is a very quick explanation. So Cushitic relates to a group of East African languages from the non-Semitic Afro-Asiatic family. Commonly known ones include Somali, which is spoken by Somalians, Oromo, and Berber from Ethiopia. Nilo-Saharan relates to a group of languages spoken by peoples who mainly trace their roots to the Upper Nile, as well as Nubia. The commonly known ones include Maasai, the Kalenjin group of languages, and Duluo. Then you have the Semitic, which relates to a group of languages that is a subfamily of the Afro-Asiatic language. The commonly known ones are Aramaic, Ethiopic, and Arabic. So in addition to these distinct linguistic families or groupings, Aksum, just because they could, went on to create their own alphabetic system, the Ge'ez script. And I'll talk about that just before we close. Ge'ez is spelled G-E apostrophe E-Z. So going back to the people. The empire's terrain was most easily described as the highlands and the lowlands. And the reason I bring this up here is because the distinction made between the lowland pastoralists and the highland folk, who eyed each other with suspicion and hostility. Those from the lowland were more often than not pastoralists, favoring a more military-style culture, with raiding and hunting being their way of life. As they migrated to the highlands, they found a very different type of lifestyle led by the inhabitants there. These people were more focused on agriculture. So then what happened is the newcomers, who had zero interest in farming or working the land in any way, ended up essentially forcing the latter to do all the work and then proceeded to collect tribute from these highlanders. I mean, how rude, really, how rude. So our warrior-type pastoralists then became the force protecting the long-distance caravan trade that sustained the economy, and they went further to secure the markets and trade routes by taking control. That is the very, very simplified version. So let's take a step back to the Agao, who I mentioned earlier. They had actually been conquered very early on by Negus Azana, and they play a significant role in Aksum's history because it's from them that the Zagwe dynasty emerges and then takes control of Aksum. Legend has it that they were led into this takeover by Negesta Yodit. So Negesta Nagastat, which means Queen of Queens, Yodit. Her people took over from Negus Dangajan's son, Dil Naod, the last Solomonic dynasty of Aksum, which basically meant that it put an end to the actual empire. Don't worry, we haven't gotten to the demise yet. This is just a note. The Zagwe then ruled over a new empire for at least a further 2 centuries, and they had been well placed and well integrated into the political corridors of power, exerting their influence and playing a part of the valuable trade routes for precious minerals such as gold. In fact, of these lucrative trade routes, one that ran through the Lake Tana was actually under the protection of the governor of Agao. Quick fun fact time. Lake Tana is a source of the Blue Nile, which then links up with the White Nile in Khartoum, modern Sudan. And as these two, plus Atbara in northern Sudan, are the main tributaries of the Nile River. The actual source of the Nile is one that is still shrouded in mystery, it seems, but many claim that Lake Namlolwe, that sits between Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania, is one of the most likely tributaries. So, interesting facts. Alphabets. So we spoke earlier about the creation of an alphabet and the interesting linguistics around the Aksumites. So I just wanted to say a little bit more about that before we close. Cool? Remember earlier when we heard about the dating system for the Ethiopians, the very complicated one, whose roots are in the Aksum Empire. So you can imagine the level of intellectual sophistication they actually had. Aksum went on to create the Ge'ez writing system around the 4th century. It's an alphabetic script based on the Ge'ez language that was spoken widely until about the 12th century AD. It is written from left to right, unlike other similar Semitic scripts. The original script didn't have any vowels, and these were added later. According to the tradition of the Ethiopian Orthodox Tewahedo Church, the script was divinely revealed to Enos, grandson of the first man, Adam. Anyway, it is said that the Armenian alphabet that was created in AD 406 by Mesrop Mashtots used the Aksum alphabet as a model. There are till today great similarities between the two, and I would love to hear from our African fam as to this claim and any place AfriWatu can find sources to share with our AfriWatu people. There was great congruence. Yani, I love what I do because I can use these words without seeming completely pretentious. But really, I am. There was great congruence between the two civilizations, and this was based on the shared Christian beliefs and the presence of Aksum on the Arabs' lands that it had conquered. So, as we wrap up, just to mention a world event that happened that's of interest is in 116 BC, Ptolemy of Egypt dies and is succeeded by his wife Cleopatra III and his son Ptolemy IX. So coming up in part two, please guys, make sure you tune in for part two as we finish off this awesome empire by covering the governance structure, two significant rulers, one a legend and the other the founder of the empire. Then we talk about the rise of Christianity. Yes, people, it did not come from the colonizers. In fact, Aksum was the third African civilization to convert to this religion. And then ultimately, we'll look at its devise. So as I bring it home, to round off this episode, just a reminder, this civilization was both economically and culturally a beast for hundreds of years, starting in the 1st century to the 10th century AD, with the city of Aksum having come into existence from about 400 BC. Please, just count those years, people. Now, it's worth saying, only because, well, it's worth saying, that to get us to question the common narratives we have been told about our history, I always ask you, please question them. So what I mean is, like, with Aksum, long ago we saw the claims that its origins were South Arabic, yet not indigenously African. Because again, how is it that Africans could have been so magnificent, right? Anyway, the claim that Damat, the precursor to Aksum, was ascribed to South Arab migrants, and though it is true that these migrations happened, no, it is not because of this that you have this great polity that was Damat or indeed Aksum. They are indigenously African. My teaching moment is over. So now, I know there were a lot of geek out moments in this episode, but you have to admit this empire really had some cool things about it. From minting its own coins for hundreds of years, to being a might across the Kebari into the Arab world, and that its global power and influence at that time was well known by other empires of their day. AfriWatu is here to help us tell our story, so my people, scratch the surface, challenge the narrative, ask the questions, and as always, go and do your own deeper research. And until next time, Mubarikiwe.